So the last time we had a conversation, which was so good and so juicy, and so many people loved it, something that you said was when we were talking about self-love and all of the work that you had done in exploring your internal world and trying to love yourself and learning to love yourself. At one point you said, I could love different aspects of myself, but I could never love my whole self because I looked in the mirror and I hated what I saw. And this, like I said, this conversation resonated with a lot of people. And I actually had somebody write a comment that really jumped out at me. She said, right in the middle of the last interview, you both talk about the get real conversation that begins the process of self-love. And I think that I'm there, but I'm having a really hard time. And she puts really in all caps. So a really hard time looking and touching my body and thinking that it's beautiful. I can think it, but I don't believe it at all. So, did you have a point like this where you were, trying to say, I love you, or you were doing affirmations, or whatever it was you were doing? You were just like, I don't believe it. I'm not going anywhere with this.
Oh yeah, the process of self-love when it came to my body was a long process. Like it wasn't an overnight thing, and it definitely when I started it felt like I was a fraud. I would say it's like I was trying to pretend like I was in love with a man that I wasn't in love with. I love you, honey, but I don't. I'm just saying it, but I think it was through my it was I was going through this process at the same time I was having my like on my spiritual journey. Like I said in in our former conversation, I grew up most of my life as an atheist. I didn't even believe there was a soul, let alone have a relationship with my soul. And I just so happened to start this journey of self-love during the time where I was starting my journey into understanding spirituality and connecting to my soul. And that happened at a time when I started down the road of Kundalini yoga. And I think that it's all over different disciplines and in different works and different historical references that, there's mind, body, and spirit. It's sort of like the Holy Trinity. And I think that really that's the key to the whole thing. I actually heard somebody recently on another podcast that I listened to describe mind, body, soul in such a beautiful way. And I want to share it. So, basically, this person said that he had this awakening experience, and he really understood that he was of three different parts. There was a part of him that he called his soul body, and that is a part of us that is our greatest self. It is like the highest form of who we can be. It's when we're expressing our greatest gifts, and it is like the saint-like God-connected part of us. That's our soul body. That's one aspect of who we are. And then there's the mind, and the mind is here to protect us and to ground us and allow us to communicate and to function on this earth. And the mind is a friend and a foe because it's so protective of us. It can also sabotage us. And so you have to like look at your mind with some love, but also with a little bit of cynicism, or it may not, your mind may not be a trusted narrator. You need to definitely question your mind because it can certainly sabotage you. And there's a lot of instinctual, protective, survival programming that your mind brings to the table. And then there's your body, and your body he described as like made of clay, which is, I think, from the Bible, or there's, I can't remember, it's a historical reference. Yeah. And he said, your body is this idea of being on the earth. It's what makes you a person. It's like the Homo sapien part of you. And your body is full of senses, and it's about indulgence and lust and eating and sex and pleasure. And it's also important. So all three of these things are super important. And it's about kind of finding a balance between those three things. And for me, in order for me to really love and appreciate my body, I needed to connect with my soul. And I think Kundalini yoga was a way to do that. And so, my suggestion to anybody who's having a hard time loving their body is to maybe let your body go for a while and focus on nourishing your soul and your mind, because it will come. Loving your body can come through those other angles. If you focus on the other parts, I think that your body then by default will your relationship to yourself, to your body, to the world, to your senses will change and shift in a positive way as you heal those other aspects of yourself.
100%. I'm so glad that you said that. We're never going to just magically like the way our body looks if we don't like who's living inside. And I think if we don't like the way that we feel in our bodies or that we feel in our lives. And I was just having this conversation. This is a little bit of a side thing, conversation with a client. And she was noticing that on days when she felt really good and really connected with herself and like everything was right with the world, she would look in the mirror and be like, oh my gosh, I look so great today. Like, you know, feeling really good about things. And on days when she felt really bad about herself or like she failed at something or she just woke up and she didn't know why she felt anxious, she looked in the mirror and it just felt like the worst, most crushing thing to see. And I really think that we often look as good as we feel, and that shows on the outside. And two, until we are loving and understanding the being inside, nothing is going to change. And to me, even, I don't know, tell me if you agree with this. When I say love your body, to me, it's not even really about what it looks like. It's about this, this vehicle that we inhabit, like loving it just because it is ours. Like you would love a child just because that child is yours. And whether you like the way it looks on any given day or not, it's just kind of bonus. I don't know. What do you think?
I completely agree. And I think in the beginning, when it doesn't feel natural, that's what you have to connect to. In fact, you know, I think that when you think, I connected so much in the beginning to the idea of childhood. So mm-hmm. I love children. I don't have any myself and I don't know that I will, but I adore children because to me, they're so pure of spirit. They have this, mm-hmm. this innocence and a sweetness to them. And they have so much to teach us, truly. If we can humble ourselves to really observe, there's so much there. And it's funny because I was going on a walk the other day and I was thinking about this idea of how we learn to reject ourselves. Like, where does that come from? You know, because I think to myself, no one can really hurt me. The only hurt I really ever feel is when I reject myself.
Right.
Because there are times when other people judge me and I think they are so off base that I completely ignore it. You know, I'm like, you are crazy. That is not true. You're not right about me.
Yeah.
And then there are times where I do believe them. And the real pain comes when I reject myself, when I feel ashamed of myself, when I think they're right and I turn my back on me. And that's where the pain and suffering comes. It's never from anybody else because I have to buy into it. If I don't buy into it, it doesn't hurt.
That's exactly
it. Only when I buy into it that it hurts. And so this idea of self-rejection is really important because it's so easy to project and say, well, the world judges my body. The world says I'm wrong. And there's something to that. But really, it's when we internalize those images and those feelings and we create these mental programs that is really the problem. And children, it's so cute because I always think when I see a baby, I love chunky babies. I think it's pretty common that people think fat, chunky babies are adorable and lovable and pinchable and sweet. Yeah. And I've said for years that like you get like about 3 years to be chunky and it's awesome. And then for some reason, like it's a total liability. And children, you know, they don't know not to love their bodies. They're so free in their bodies and they're so happy in their bodies and they love to dance and they love to move and explore. And it's not until they get to a certain age where they start learning these other things that are in society, that are in, you know, the network that we live in, they start learning these other messages and then everything kind of can change for them.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. And I'm always saying that body love is natural and people look at me like I'm crazy. Or I guess I should say the people that I work with where we're talking about this specifically. But it's so natural. It's built into us. You see a baby and they're so fascinated with their toes and they'll like squish their arms and there's no self-loathing. That is not a natural thing. It's learned, just like you're saying.
Absolutely. And it's funny because you know, you think about it and, you know, we internalize so much self-loathing and so much self-hatred. I think especially women, I'm not trying to take anything away from men. I don't think it's easy at all to be in a body you don't love, whether you're a man or a woman at all. I think there's an extra layer, as a woman, at least in this culture, and that we have so many images of perfection that are contradictory and impossible that it is like, insecurity as a woman is almost impossible to not have. I mean, it's like, it is so everywhere. You know, we're constantly told we're not enough. It's like everywhere we look, there's Photoshop images, there's conflicting ideas of what a woman is and what it should look like. It's always through the male lens. And it's very destructive, I think. And, you know, I think we internalize a lot of that, and we internalize misogyny and self-hatred. You know, I don't know if you ever heard about the study that was done at Howard University in the 1940s, but there was a group of children, ages 3 to 7, and they were African-American children, and they were given a bunch of baby dolls that looked identical, except they had different colored skin, and they were in diapers. And so they gave these little children these baby dolls, and they said, you know, name which baby dolls are beautiful and nice and happy, and tell me which ones are ugly and bad. And it was really sad, because what happened was the African-American children named the fair-skinned baby dolls as being pretty and nice, and they labeled the, you know, darker-skinned baby dolls as being ugly and bad. And you can feel the sorrow in that, because they internalized the culture. They internalized that. I mean, that's learned. There's no doubt that living in a culture that elevates one race over another is toxic to the people who aren't in that race. And I think the same thing happens in our society with women, and that because our culture does, for some reason, elevate masculinity above femininity, I think that there is that internalized self-doubt and hatred that comes with being a woman. And it's really about trying to unpack and change that programming. And I think that it's incumbent upon all of us to sort of examine those parts of us. They got there not by conscious decision. You know, I never sat down one day and decided that I wasn't good enough because I was a woman, or, you know, parts of femininity were weak. But I internalized that because that's the air that I breathe and the water that I swim in as a fish. You know, that's the culture. And I think that it's really important to examine those things and to recognize them in those things in us and forgive them, you know, because it wasn't self-determined. It was something that was sort of in a default mode and programmed within us.
Yes, it's not our fault as children. And as children, we don't really have choices about what we're given. We just sort of take it on as truth. And I think it's just what you were talking about in the beginning, about how we are these mind, body, spirit beings. And the mind is an incredible tool. And because of all that we've been given, we need to be very, we need to ask a lot of questions about if what's in here and what's driving us is actually true.
Absolutely. And we can't just go and let our mind run in default and assume that everything that our mind is narrating is truth. That meditation, to get back to, like, you know, Kundalini and how that my paths kind of collide, meditation allowed me to examine my mind and examine my patterns of thinking and understand that there's a difference between my identity and my thoughts, that I am not my thoughts and my thoughts are not me. And it's a very interesting concept. And I remember when I first heard it, before I went down the path of actually meditating, when I was having an intellectual relationship to those ideas, it was very confusing and actually quite, I remember having like a lot of anxiety around that thought. Like, and I'm sure that's my ego trying to protect itself, right? Which was trying to say, well, my ego, my thoughts, that is who I am. You know, I wanted to continue to have that identity with the ego and with my thoughts. But as I continued on that road of spiritual practice and self-discovery and meditation and yoga, I was able to truly kind of get a sense of separation between my true identity, which I believe is my soul, and my mind, my ego, which is this idea, this identity, this outside structure of who I am and these thoughts. Like, that's not necessarily always true. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not about discrediting or trying to obliterate the mind and the ego. It's just about recognizing its inherent problems and its inherent deficiencies, you know, and what it really is there for. And, you know, I think the more that I was able to separate my soul and my identity as a spiritual person from my identity with my ego and with my thoughts, the more that I was able to examine the patterns and programs that were hurtful and mean and not true about myself, and to again start down that path of true self-love of my body. So
It's so useful because we do, until we get any sort of space, it really just feels like, it feels like the thoughts are us, first of all, and then it feels like the thoughts are obviously true. And then we're taught, and I think we talked about this in the last conversation too, that if a thought is painful, then it's obviously true. And it's really quite the opposite. And something that I do with a lot of people to tie this back in with the mirror thing is to stand in front of the mirror and just see what thoughts come up. Because usually we're just running on default. We walk in front of the mirror, everything is shit, everything is awful, it affects the rest of your day, da 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 da. But to take some really conscious time, if somebody is working with the mirror, to like set a timer for 5 minutes or 10 minutes and stand there and look and just see what thoughts come up and then write them down. So if it's like, I look fat, I hate my thighs, this is terrible, I'm a terrible person, like whatever it is that comes up, just take notes so that you can actually see it out in front of you. And then begin to notice how many of these thoughts are painful. And in a lot of our cases, as we're just beginning this, it's like all of them. And then to see if you can begin to create some separation. And this is to say, like, for somebody who hasn't gotten into meditation, or if meditation, like, they're not settled enough to be able to just sit and create any space yet, but to have it out on paper and just create space between, okay, I'm in my body and here are these thoughts out on paper and I can clearly see that these are not true. Now, can I give some space and be actually able to engage with the part of me that's having these thoughts? And I think that we talked about this before too, like if we could even attribute this to the child within us who was given these thoughts and these ideas from society or from family, and can I begin to nurture that part of me? For me, this is self-love before you're able even to look in the mirror and fake saying you look cute today or whatever.
Absolutely. And I've got a wonderful woman that I know told me about this thing that she's done, and it's really, really beautiful in a lot of ways. One thing that I've thought about, again, I love connecting to the child within because I think there's so much there. There's so much richness there. Is that she said, you know, take a picture that you have of yourself when you were a little kid and say those things to that child, that 2, 3, 4-year-old, sweet, innocent, happy child. It's still you. You know, I had this picture that me and my sister on the couch just being silly little girls. And when I mean to myself, I think to myself, like, I would never say that to that little girl. I would never call her names or say that she wasn't good enough. Like that's horrible. That's abusive. You know, like that's ugly behavior. That's not, I would never be abusive to a child that's so sweet and innocent. And that's still me. Like I'm not any different. I'm just matured. I've just been here on this planet for just more years, but that essence of me is still there. I'm still that 2-year-old child. Nothing has really changed.
And I would say that as children, we don't really have the capacity to do anything but absorb what's going in around us. Like we don't really have the capacity to do this self-questioning work. And so if we're living as that child who has all of these beliefs and without question is still kind of living as victim to all of it, then we're going to be in pain for a really, really long time. But as an adult, we have the capacity, like we actually have the capacity to, I think you were talking about rewire things and things, and Kundalini does this brilliantly, helps us see things from many perspectives, a much bigger perspective.
Absolutely. I think that it's a very interesting road. I really believe that if you need to crack the nut on self-love, I would suggest that focus on the mind and the body, or mind and spirit, if you can't get a grip on the body. It's just such a beautiful, powerful way through. And they talk about that in Kundalini, this idea of like angles and triangles. You know, you don't take a direct path to something. And I've realized that that is such a beautiful technique in so many levels. You know, for instance, when I hear somebody and I know that they, I feel like I have advice for them. I used to, before I started, you know, my former self would have been really direct and said, you should do this, you know, you should do this. Yeah. And, people are turned off by that a lot. You know, people don't really like to be told what to do. And I've found as I matured and I grew that when I find that I have advice for somebody, instead of directly saying, you should do this, I tell a personal story. Yeah. Or a story about somebody else. And I allow that person, if they are so interested in what I'm saying, to make that connection themselves. That I'm telling a story that applies to their situation. And if they decide in their consent to understanding the parallel, then they can consent to understanding that it could apply to them and then take that on. And again, that's just this idea of like not directing things, not going right to the heart of things, but taking sort of an angled approach to things, you know, and letting things kind of go there at an angled approach. I don't know. Does that make sense to you?
100%. Yeah, no, I totally love that. And I feel like it's a lot more empowering too, because I think when we get the advice, it's this instant devastating, even if we don't realize it, like, oh my God, I've been doing it wrong. And we don't want to hear that. But if we're able to just hear a story and connect, and that like connects to your heart and your whole body just kind of softens, then it's like, it gives you the ability to figure it out for yourself without feeling like, you know, you're under attack, even if the person giving advice is so beautifully well-intentioned.
100%, because it is very confronting to our minds and our egos and our sense of identity when somebody's kind of saying you're doing it wrong. You know, there's this idea of defensiveness, of trying to get into defense mode and protect and you know, dismiss and say that you're still valuable and defend yourself, right? There's definitely that sense about it. So it's, again, this way around it.
To that point, when we're working with ourselves, if we're just standing in front of the mirror and we've had this whole history of self-loathing and thinking that we're not worthy because our body's a certain way, if we're just standing there being like, you're beautiful, oh my God, believe it, why can't you believe it? It's kind of threatening to this part of us that has been believing something a certain way for a very, very long time. And I think it's actually more useful, if we're really having a hard time with that, to be able to soften and speak with ourselves and be like, okay, so you don't think you're beautiful. Like, okay, I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry that you feel that way. I'm so sorry that that was handed to you, and just let that be okay for a while. And that, just like you were saying in the conversations that you have with people, there's a softening there when we kind of just let things be okay, let ourselves be okay, and witness ourselves at the same time. So not the apathetic sort of acceptance, but like, wow, this is really what I believe, and just hanging out with it. And I think that the transformation from there is a lot more natural.
I agree. And another kind of different way to, like I said, this idea of not taking a direct approach, not just like trying to be. And again, I think there's this like masculine energy that's very direct. And I love that. I mean, that's something to be, that's beautiful. There's so much beauty in masculine energy and so much beauty in feminine energy. But I think that there's a lot of default to masculine energy in the world right now. And there has been for generations, which is this like very direct way of doing things. And I think there's this deep intelligence with more feminine way of doing things, more rounded, more subtle, more accommodating, less direct. And another way that I think you could approach this is I found that the more that I can accept myself, the more than I can accept others. And the reverse is true as well. The more that I can accept others, the more that I find that I can accept myself, because we are really connected. There's very much this symbiosis between those two concepts, between our relationship to self and other, our relationship to self in the world. And if you understand the interconnectedness of that, an approach could be that you start questioning the thoughts you have about people who you think have similar body types as you. When you see somebody who you think has a very similar body type, what do you think about that person? Do you value that person? Do you see their goodness? Do you see that? Can you love them? Can you appreciate them? Can you value them? Are they valuable and worthy of love? And if it's too painful and difficult for you to confront that in yourself, maybe you can work on doing that with other people. I find that I can be really, really compassionate with other people. It's just a natural talent of mine. And I think a lot of people have an easier time being forgiving of other people than themselves. And I think that that's another way, another opportunity to, again, indirectly start addressing those feelings about yourself, is to appreciate and love other people who you feel maybe have the same similar body issues or whatever your issues are. Find those issues in them. And my guess is initially you're going to have trouble with it, because again, what we reject and deny about ourselves, we tend to project into the world. But that's another way, an indirect way, to start confronting that narrative in your mind and unpacking that energy.
Yeah, I love that. And sometimes we have to take it in steps too, because I've had similar conversations with people, and often that can be a first step, and seeing other people and realizing like, oh, I can see the beauty in them. Like you said, it can be easier to see in other people. What I'll hear is, well, she's beautiful at that weight, but that's unacceptable for me.
Interesting.
Which is unfortunate. I think it's having, like, I love that we're talking about all of these tools, because everybody's mind, like, for some people, that's the perfect thing. Like, oh my God, I would never say this to a child or to that other person, or I think that other person's beautiful. And so of course I'm capable of seeing that within myself. Angles, like you're saying, sometimes we need all of these different angles, all of these different tools, because we have such a wide variety of experiences as human beings.
No, that's very interesting. Yeah. It's very fascinating. But so to go back to Kundalini, I think Kundalini for me, is another example of this idea of angles, right? So, my issue about not connecting to the soul, before in my previous experience in life was that my mind had an issue with authority, and the soul and God had always come through this idea of this, like, very authoritarian, a person telling me how it's going to be, having all these rules. It was very intellectual and very guilt driven. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get there. You know what I mean? I rejected it. I felt like it was wrong and it was no good. And so because of that, I threw away the whole concept of soul. You know, it was like, I put the soul in that garbage bin with all of that, and I just threw it away. And, the beautiful thing about Kundalini was that when I went in the first day, I was still an atheist. I was open, way more open than I had been in the past, obviously, to go and to try to pursue meditation and yoga. Obviously you have to have some sort of openness. But I wasn't at all understanding or seeking a soul connection with myself. I still wasn't even sure what that was or that I was even important. But the beautiful thing about Kundalini that I loved is that it was about working with the body and the mind to connect with the soul. It's again, that triangle that I needed. It was going to the angle. So I did the breath work. I did the body work. You know, I did the sitting with my mind work, and through those connecting to the body and the mind, I actually developed a soul body. I just developed a relationship with my soul. So again, it's that angles and triangles with that mind, body, spirit is so fascinating. There's so many ways that you can bypass directly focusing on what you want to heal by focusing on the other two areas. And I really appreciated that with Kundalini. It allowed me to develop this relationship with such an important, really my true identity, which was my soul, that was completely just, you know, not even a part of my life. And I did it on accident. I was just like, oh, I'm just here to move my body and to do a little meditation. And all of a sudden my whole soul healed and bloomed and blossomed on accident. You know, it wasn't even something I was looking to do.
Well, I think that's very often how our growth is. I think we try too hard sometimes in the self-help and the spirituality world. I think it's, and we were talking about this before we got on the conversation, and you were saying about how, like, you know, you just want to be useful and it's not about what you have to say. And I was like, I think it is about what you have to say. I think that if you're excited about something, then that is a message that needs to be out in the world. And it means that there are people that really want to hear it. So, oh my gosh, by all means, please say what you specifically are excited to say. And so I really think that if we are tapped in and just following the next thing and taking the next step and seeing what we're genuinely excited about, which of course requires being honest about what I'm genuinely excited about, not what's been put on me by society or family, etc., we can just keep following those breadcrumbs and things blossom really naturally. And I also love that you got into this as an atheist, because I think for as many turbans and unfamiliar words and as weird as Kundalini yoga looks, it's all about the experience for me. And it's the way that I want to bring Kundalini to the world is just very grounded. Because you clearly don't need to believe in a God or a soul to have a huge impact on you. Because at the first level, you are just working with your body and you're working with your nervous system and your brain and all of these different, you know, the Kundalini yoga, it affects every aspect of it. We're working with different organs. It's very, very grounded in the beginning. And we need those roots to be able to get anywhere else, to access any other part of our being. And even if you're not interested in that, it doesn't matter. It's still going to create space for you to be able to work with your minds and all of these, your mind, I guess we could say minds. We could say negative mind, positive mind, neutral mind.
Absolutely.
And be able to work with all of these belief systems that we're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. I think to me, Kundalini was an absolute destiny for me. I don't know that I would have gotten to my soul any other way, just based upon the way that my mind was wired at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it could have happened as quickly and as powerfully. My mind was so cynical that had I not gotten there through the body and the breath, I don't know that it would have happened. So I'm just so super grateful that there is a technology out there, that there is a methodology out there that can use the body to get to these other parts. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to me. And it's just, it's incredible. I'm curious, tell me, you recently went to a more in-depth training that I was not able to attend here in Seattle. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I love that you're interviewing the interviewer. Yeah.
I know, because I'm interested.
Well, it's really interesting that you bring this up now because you were talking about cynicism. And so I went to the level 2 training on stress and vitality with Guru Singh. And I learned so much about the way that our bodies respond to stress. So not just the stress that we are dealing with day in and day out in our world as it is, but the stress that we're carrying with us from all of the trauma that we experienced as children, all of the belief systems that we experienced and took on as children, we're carrying all of that with us if it hasn't been processed. So we're living in this constant state of stress on top of stress. And we can manifest stress in so many ways, mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And one of those ways is actually being very, very cynical. That's a reflection of the stress, probably the accumulated stress that we've been carrying since childhood. And so I love that you talked about like going in with this cynicism, and Kundalini was able to open and soften and give you, because I feel like cynicism, I think there's a usefulness to it, but it can be very limited if it's like one dimensional. I don't know if I'm describing that properly. But if you open up, then that's just like a healthy use of your negative mind, which is just discerning. But then also you have the positive mind and the neutral mind, and you get to see things again, angles, all of these perspectives.
Fascinating. Yeah, I would imagine that my cynicism certainly was a compilation of stress throughout my lifetime.
Yeah. So I found that very, very fascinating. And it's really made an impact in the way that I work with clients, because now I'm able to see different symptoms that they're having that I may not have looked at before. I would have saw them as symptoms, but I wouldn't have seen it in this really direct way as this accumulated stress and the way, and for myself too, I've seen things in myself that we get used to things. It's like, oh, this is just how I am. This is normal. This is life. But the deeper we dig, we're like, oh, that's not normal at all. And that's actually really painful. And oh my gosh, that's a symptom that's been there for so, so, so long. And now we have tools to begin to work with these symptoms and get to the root of them.
What is the definition of stress? I'm curious. Like what, can you kind of talk about how they define stress in that context? Because I would imagine it's an interesting perspective. Everything Kundalini to me is always interesting and a little bit more expanded than I would typically come in thinking it is.
Yeah, totally. So Guru Singh was talking about how stress can actually, if we are to sit with our stress, so sit with the stress that comes up in our mind, in our body, and we're able to sit there in deep listening and calm rather than judging it, because what we tend to do is like, oh my God, I'm so stressed. I've done something wrong, or everything's gone wrong, or I'm the victim of this, or this is just happening. This is just random. But if we're to sit with it, we can eventually get to a place where we understand it and the class was not just on stress, it was stress and vitality. So the stress eventually can transform into vitality. It's like the seeds of something, the seeds of who we have the potential to become. And without all of the traumas and the stresses, et cetera, that we received as we were growing up, we wouldn't have these seeds to become the interesting, dynamic people that we have the possibility of being. So it's never about just like getting rid of stress, or like I often talk about getting rid of binge eating or whatever the symptom is. It's about deeply understanding it so that it can grow and blossom and become part of the mature human being that we're growing into.
Fascinating. Wow. That's really interesting. So hard. Well, yeah. And that comes back to, you know, full circle about how we started the conversation, which is, you know, one of the beautiful things I got out of having such a negative relationship to myself and to my body, and then learning to transform that and transmute that into self-love, is that I have so much compassion for other people who are going through that. You know, it's like, I have this idea in my mind that I want to have this perfect, easy life with no struggle and just ease and just happiness and just joy. And yet I also have this deep desire to be of service to others and to make an impact, a positive impact in this world. And I have to remind myself that nobody really needs to hear from or cares about the perspective of somebody who has had a perfect and easy life.
Right.
What do they have to share and teach anybody?
Right. I don't think that's the experience that we're here to have.
No.
And so, I remember going through, and please hang on to your thought. I remember going through a period where post the worst of my eating disorder, I felt so angry. I was like, I can't believe that I wasted so much of my time focused on food and my body and the diet industry is bullshit. And I was so angry about everything. And of course, now I have so much more perspective and I'm so, so grateful for absolutely everything I went through. But yeah, we do tend to get really, really angry and just think, when are things going to be easy? Or why did I have to go through this?
Exactly. And so the other end of that kind of journey into the desert where you're leaving, you're willing to leave the first thought pattern, which is, I reject myself. I don't love myself. I'm not good enough. And before you get to the destination of self-love, when you're in that space, that liminal space of in the desert wandering, wondering when if you're ever going to get to this destination, the thing I think that you can remind yourself during that time of uncertainty and in the in-between is that there is so much that comes from this journey. You know, keep going because it is gold on the other end of that. There is gold in the healing of that trauma. And there's so much there and it's worth it. You know, that it's worth the struggle. It's worth the healing. It was even worth the pain because on the other end of all of our struggles is so much beauty and so much gold. And it makes us better and more whole people. And so my advice to anybody who's going through that and they feel uncertain and they don't know if they can do it or if it's worth it or anything is to just trust that there is something, there is a purpose behind it, that there is a truth behind it, and that there is a better person on the other end of this and a more wise and a more caring and a more loving and a more compassionate individual on the other end of this journey into the desert, into the abyss.
Yes, absolutely. And I hope that that's really encouraging because I end up having to talk a lot of people through these periods because we have such a before and after culture. Like today, everything is awful. But then when I get my after story, when I lose the weight or when I'm healed or when I'm enlightened or whatever the thing is, then everything's going to be perfect and wonderful. So once I just get there, but it's like we go through layers and we go through cycles and we go through seasons. And if we think of seasons, it's like spring, summer, winter, fall. And sometimes we're in a season of fall or winter where things feel like, oh my gosh, I've been working so hard and I don't know how to do this. I don't know if I'm ever going to get where I want to go. And things feel kind of dark and hopeless. And I think first of all, being able to see real people who have walked through that through many seasons and many layers of these things is a glimmer of hope. And looking at the natural way that life works, because everything mirrors everything. So life goes through seasons. Winter never lasts forever, not in nature, not in our experience. And then to take that as a call to rest and be really, really, really sweet to yourself. Because if we go back to the conversation about the child in us, you're not a taskmaster to a child. Like when a kid needs to rest, a kid needs to rest. When we need to rest, we need to rest.
Absolutely.
And well, self-care and endless compassion.
Absolutely. So my words of love to anyone who's listening and going through that journey of self-love is just to take it one day at a time and be patient with yourself. Be patient. Be kind, you know, be as sweet and kind and loving to yourself as you would a 4-year-old. You know, you don't get there through, discipline and bearing down on it. You get there through being sweet and kind and patient. It will come. It will come, you know, and it's a journey. It's not, it's not instant gratification. So when you start looking in the mirror and you start having those thoughts that don't make sense, that you think, oh, I love my body and I'm beautiful. And yet your soul and your heart says, that's not true. You know, the head and the heart, give it time, let it unfold. It can and will happen, but it's a journey. It's a process. You know, if it were as easy as looking in the mirror and just reciting a line, we'd all be absolutely in love with ourselves.
Exactly. And I think that with each season, I think that we're doing different sorts of work. Like perhaps when there's more energy, it's more of a summer season. Maybe you are doing more affirmations and journaling and introspective work. And when you're tired, maybe you're just resting more and letting that be okay. And I think if anything is steady throughout all of that and just show up day after day with it, it is that kindness and that compassion for right where you're at. Which brings me to something I wanted to ask you about as far as just steadiness and showing up, your 1,000-day meditation.
So it's interesting, the synchronicity here today, Randy, is today is my 1.5-year anniversary.
What?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Today. So April 13th, 2017, I was day one of my 1,000-day commitment of meditation. And so in Kundalini yoga, they talk about, you know, meditation is something, it's about confronting the mind. And it's, they, a lot of meditation in Kundalini is mantra meditation. So you chant these different mantras. A lot of them are not in the English language. And there's a relationship between chanting and sound and your mind. And they say that the foundation of happiness is commitment. That's like one of the basis of Kundalini. And I've, for a long time, I think I've had a real struggle with commitment. I tend to get super excited about something and then I fizzle out or I burn out. And, you know, commitment has been something that I struggle with. And so I, you know, they encourage the practitioner to begin by committing to a 40-day meditation. And the idea of a 40-day meditation is to establish a habit. And then there's different increments, and I can't remember exactly. I think there's 60 days and, I don't know, 120 days. There's different increments, and they basically say, like, at 40 days, you begin a habit, and then on and on and on. But then the ultimate longest commitment you can make to a meditation is 1,000 days, which is a little over 3 years, or under 3 years, something along those lines. And a little under 3 years. But the idea that if you commit to a 1,000-day meditation, you become that meditation. You become whatever meditation you're doing and the qualities of that meditation, you actually become and embody that meditation and that that aspect that you're meditating on. And so I challenged myself to do a 1,000-day meditation, which if I was being honest with myself, I have never been able to be that disciplined in any area of my life, ever. I think brushing my teeth is probably the most committed I've ever been to a practice and discipline. You know, every day I pretty much brush my teeth. But for the most part, that's like the only practice in, that I've really been able to be disciplined for 1,000 days at a time. Almost anything else I would, you know, take breaks from or walk away from and maybe come back to or maybe drop altogether. So it's been really interesting. The meditation that I do is called Long Akankar, and I believe it's the beginning lines to the Sikh mantras that they do. And I do 11 minutes every day. And it's been a really interesting journey. I'm just very committed to it. It's funny because after the first, 120 days or so, I started having these like really, there's a lot of anxiety came up that I was going to forget. That I was going to forget and fail. And so every day I almost like had anxiety where like I would like wake up and the first thing I would think of was, did I meditate yesterday? You know what I mean? Like the first thought that would come to my mind was this anxious thought of like, did I screw it up? You know, like, I don't want to screw this up. And that was an interesting thing to confront, this idea of waking up with anxiety. And I think that was something that I had been doing for a long time in other aspects of my life. So that kind of brought that to the surface. And it's been an interesting journey. My husband participates with me now, and he's been very encouraging. In the past, he would have maybe looked at that commitment and not understood it and try to encourage me to like drop it because it was inconvenient for us. You know, he wanted to watch TV and I had to go meditate, or he wanted to do this and I had to go meditate, but he was actually really encouraging of it. And now he participates in it with me more often than not. So it's a wonderful thing that we do together. And it's just this foundational commitment that I made and that I followed through with. And I'm really proud of myself for doing it. And it's just made an impact in my life so far. So it's something I would definitely recommend to somebody who is curious about that and wants to challenge themselves to rise to the occasion of something, is to carve out 11 minutes. I mean, 11 minutes is not that challenging. I don't think anyone doesn't have 11 minutes of their day to do something. And if you don't have 11 minutes in your day to do something, then you should probably rethink your life.
Right. And what was your, I'm so curious about this. What was your motivation to begin with? Was it the, like, I've never really committed to anything like this before. I want to see what that feels like. Or was there something about this meditation? Like, what was pulling you? Was there a sense of like, well, this is just right. This is just what's next.
That's an interesting story. So at the time, I was partnering with my yoga teacher to build a yoga village in Seattle. And it was a huge project, and I was so taken by it. And I still am very interested in that project. And I dedicated the practice to seeing that to fruition. And it this point, we are not working on it right now. So I definitely have a very openness to that project, and I'm very curious about where this is all leading, but it's deeper than that. I started with this idea of something outside of me, that I was going to do this practice to show my commitment to this big project. And I think that I definitely tied my ego and my identity to getting this project done. And, you know, it was a great thing outside of myself to connect it to. But since then, it's evolved, and it really is about me showing up for me and me committing to something. And that's really what it's evolved to. But I'm interested to see where this leads me, because it was a very clear intention in the beginning, and I have definitely followed through on my commitment in that regard. And I'm just curious if it will ever circle back around to that project, because I still very much believe in that project, and I love Kundalini, and I would love to see it have a bigger foothold in this world. So.
Well, and I think that that's just evidence to how we never need to shut any part of ourselves down, because who cares if it was your ego or your identity or whatever. Like, I think that was just how it was supposed to be. I think we start in a certain place and we're always following just the next right thing. And if that's how you got here, look how much has deepened since then. So I think that that was so perfect.
Absolutely. I've been learning. That's another thing that connecting to my soul has allowed me to do, is just to sit in suspended animation with things. Like, you don't need to put it in a box. You don't need to close the door on things. You can just let them be how they are. You don't have to say right or wrong, good or bad. Like, you know, it's not really, everything's sort of just a part of the journey. Everything just is. It's not anything. It just is. You know, it's our mind that wants to label something, and that's the duality of the mind, right? Of yes, no, right, wrong, good, bad, productive, or a waste of time. And that's another thing that I've really learned through the practice and through meditation, is that things just are. They really just are, for the most part.
It's true. And I think that we can really trust ourselves with these inklings and what comes up with us, or what comes up for us, without necessarily questioning it. Because, like, for me, I have zero desire to do a 1,000-day meditation. That sounds awful. So terrible. And I think that there could very well come a time when it sounds, oh my gosh, like, that's just right. Because there was a time when doing a 40-day meditation sounded terrible, and now a 40-day meditation is like nothing. So I think it's just sort of following breadcrumbs. And we were talking about this earlier too. I'm curious about your spiritual name and when you chose to figure out what that was. Because up until this point, I've felt like, I don't really care what my spiritual name is. But then I also have felt like there's a little bit of an opening. Like, at some point, I think I'm going to want to know. And I know there's something about it being, you know, part of it has something to do with your destiny, da da da. And I just, like, I know myself, and I know that, okay, I'm going to pull out another example. When I wanted to start shooting yoga videos, there was like a whole year where I was like, this is what I want to do, and I don't think the time is right. And I was like, am I just putting this off because I'm scared, or I'm lazy, or I'm da-da-da, whatever? And I was like, no, I just don't think it's right. But then when the time was right, it was just right. And I felt it. I was like, oh, the time is now. And then I did put it off a little bit, but I knew the time was for now. And so I trust that with certain meditations, or like, if I ever want to know what my spiritual name, or whatever the thing is, like, you can trust those inklings of desire and curiosity and interest. So to bring this back to you, what was that like for you when you were finding out what your spiritual name was? Like, what was pulling you?
First off, that's awesome that you have that, and you are like, you stand in that and you accept that, because I struggle with that. I tend to want to push and pull things. It's very, this is something that I'm learning right now in my path and my journey, is to just trust and allow things to come at the time and space that they need to. That has been an ongoing learning process for me. So kudos to you. I admire that about you. And you sharing that makes me realize that that is something I can have access to and I will at some point gain access to. For me, what was it? I was going to women's camp, which was when a bunch of, it's every year in, it's Kundalini, and it's every year after summer solstice in New Mexico, where a lot of 3HO, which is the kind of governing arm of Kundalini yoga here in the United States, where 3HO has their headquarters, is in Española, New Mexico. It's beautiful down there. And I went to women's camp. And before I went, I wanted to know my spiritual name. So I registered for it and I got it. And I really love it. In fact, for a while, I was thinking about going by the name Amrit, kind of. So my spiritual name is Amrit Darshan. Amrit means the sweet ecstasy when you unite with your soul or with infinity. It's the sweet ecstasy when you unite with infinity, which is something that, you know, can occur through spiritual practice where you kind of have a oneness, which I've been able to luckily experience through some of my spiritual practice, and it is pretty blissful. And then Darshan is the blessing of being in the presence of an enlightened master. And Darshan is something that people feel if they are with their guru. There's a lot of instances that are documented that when somebody's in the presence of somebody like the Dalai Lama, who is very present and very spiritually mature, that they feel a sense of peace themselves and that they feel a healing, a transformation in themselves that can come from just being in the presence of somebody who's enlightened or who's spiritually mature. So that's my name. It's Amrit Darshan. And I really like it. And it means a lot to me. And I'm glad that I did it.
It's beautiful. And I've always felt like Amrit really suits you.
Thank you. I love it. I've toyed with going with that kind of as my name, but right now I feel more connected to Katie and more grounded with Katie. It's a lot easier to live in the United States with a name like Katie. Sure. As boring and bland as it can be, it's not quite as sexy as Amrit, but I struggle with it because I very much feel connected to Amrit. So
yeah. Well, this has been so wonderful and such a perfect follow-up to everything that we talked about last time. Is there anything else that you really wanted to share that we weren't able to get to?
No, I just wanted to share just some genuine love and support to any viewers that are on the path of self-love. I really, having gone through it myself, I just want to encourage people who are interested and curious about it to stick to it. And to be patient and kind and gentle to themselves. It's worth it. I mean, it's worth it. And it is something that you have access to. Even if it feels like you will never have it, I can assure you that there is a way. And just not to give up on yourself because you're worth it. And, you know, that there is another side to, there is an end. You know, if you're in that space of the in-between, there is a destiny. There is a destination. And just to trust that you'll get there.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.